Where's all our cheerleaders in here? Let's try it again. Good morning.
Good morning.
Very good. We're excited to get started this morning, and we want to move right into the major presentation again by Dr. Sittler. We will have a couple of announcements. First of all, we want to remind you that after Dr. Sittler's presentation this morning, there will be a coffee break in the student center. The coffee today, the juice and coffee and cold drinks are all provided for us by the Seguin Chamber of Commerce. So if any time you have a chance to say thank you to them, we would hope that you do that. They are welcoming us here today, and they're happy to have us in our city. And so they are providing the refreshments today. The second is that we want to keep two things in mind. The workshop sessions begin this morning after the discussion period at 10:45, and we would like to start those promptly at 10:45. The locations of the various workshops have been posted in two places. The first is outside the chapel doors. There is a listing of all the workshops and modules with the posting of the locations. In Weaver Hall, they're basically in two places, Weaver Hall, which is right next door across the quad here, and Beck Hall, which is a little further over behind Weaver. The rooms you will locate in those two buildings. There will be a sign on the door with the name of the workshop, probably, if you have trouble locating it. The only other two locations are the chapel here for the music one, and the blue room is another location. So other than those two, everything is in Weaver or Beck Hall. The second place we posted the locations of the workshops is in the student center. So after this session, you can find the locations either outside the chapel door or in the student center. Yes. Yes, Bill, you want to make a comment? Your dutiful leader and servant over here in the district has been busy to make sure all those are posted. So I think everything is in order there. We want to welcome again this morning Dr. Sittler, and to thank him for opening, I think, for us last night some very powerful images of what it means to be in Christ and in ministry together in the community of the faithful. So we welcome you again, Dr. Sittler, and we look forward to your presentation.
Spend a few moments on the phrase equipping the saints. I had indeed thought I would use the entire period this morning talking about that, but early this morning when I was over here early for chapel, a man asked me a question which disclosed that there's a bottom drawer kind of question that many of you are asking, or perhaps afraid to ask, and seems to be so important I'm going to deal with that. But first, a few words about equipping the saints. We have to understand, and I presume you already do, really, and don't need much further explication, that when the word the saints is used in the scripture, it does not mean persons of notable holiness or purity of life. Saints simply means the community of believers. And that community was made up of all sorts and conditions of men and women. Paul could even write to the church at Corinth, some of you saints ought to quit getting drunk at the Lord's Supper. That's the kind of saints some of them were. So saints only later acquired the Roman Catholic notion of men and women of outstanding, even incomparable holiness and purity of life. Saints then means equipping those who are members of the community and does not imply a moral judgment of a graduation of saints and little saints, middle-sized saints and big saints. The communion of saints, as the word is used in theology and Bible, simply means the fellowship of believers. Full believers, part believers, dubious believers, fragile believers, tough believers, all kind of believers. But when that's clear, then the word equipping, I think we ought to have another look at that. The notion of, when we use the word equipping in English, we usually postulate there is a kind of standard equipment, and that if one's going to engage in a certain enterprise, of course the equipment ought to be the standard stuff. If you're going to play football, there is a standard equipment for a football player. It looks like kind of cotton wool armor, as it were. Anyhow, we've got to lay that notion aside. There is no such thing as a standard equipment for the saints. There are saints, they must be equipped, but the equipment is infinitely various. Because to realize, to actualize one's Christian life means a kind of absolutely non-negotiable particularity about every life. The kind of equipment which is appropriate to this personality or that body of gifts that constitute this or that person cannot be homogenized or standardized. Therefore, when we use the word equipping the saints, we have to dismiss the idea that the church has a warehouse of standard equipment over here and a group of waiting saints over here. We file them through like getting your uniform in the Navy or something. Equipping the saints means not a moment, but a process. Not something which can be standardized, but a way of providing, maturing, deepening the life of faith in such a way that the faith becomes more communicable, more alluring, more attractive. So other people will, beholding us, ask, what's going on here? What holds this person together? What constitutes this believer in such a way as to cause me to want to be curious about it? Now, how do you make a catalog out of that? Let me use an illustration of certain saints in the church, and then you reflect upon how madly different their particular equipment was. In the 4th century, 4th and 5th century, the church was beginning to move into what later became known as the Dark Ages, in which the ancient cities of the empire, Alexandria, Constantinople, Rome, Ephesus, and so forth, these cities were being overrun either by inward decay or outward conquest by the barbarians from the north. And the man who is probably one of the great, great figures in church history is Saint Augustine. He by his work of the mind, he pulled this community together. in such a way that, according to one historian, he taught the Christians to outlive, outthink, and outdie the pagan world. It's a memorable phrase. He said, the church historian, I think it was Harnack who first used the word, said, it was Augustine's contribution to the church that he helped them outthink, outlive, and outdie the pagan world. Look at each of the phrases. The early church in the 4th and 5th centuries outthought the pagan world because the old intellectual framework of paganism, of the Greek and Roman gods and goddesses and the whole philosophy and metaphysics of the pagan world, was in complete decline and decay, had in a sense become rotten at the core. And Augustine's great work on the doctrine of the Holy Trinity, doctrine of the Incarnation, his doctrine about grace and sin and redemption, really moved in to fill the gap that had that was evacuated by the failure of nerve, philosophy, the political system of the Roman Empire. He outfought the pagan world and brought the Christian community along with him. They outlived the pagan world. Outlived, that is, in the sheer elevation, resolution, and discipline, and morality of their life. As the pagan world became more and more polluted, and those of you who saw the television series I, Claudius, had some look into what was happening in the pagan world from the end of the 1st to the 4th and 5th centuries. The Christian community became a cadre of people who could be trusted, who were honored by the strange moral severity of their lives, by their positive outlook toward the reality of God, the future of the world, and their duty in history. They outthought, they outlived, and perhaps most importantly of all, they outdied the pagan world. Those of you who saw, again, the I, Claudius television series on the perversions of the late period of paganism, remember how Lavinia, that brutal, unbelievable woman, at the last days of her evil life, she fell into a strange frenzy because she knew she was old, was about to die, and the only way to secure any life beyond her own death was to be made a goddess. And she appealed to her own son, who then was emperor, to make her a goddess in order that upon her death she would not be annihilated. Well, it was over against that awesome fear which lay like a cloud over the pagan world. The Christians, according to the historian Eusebius, lived their life with a superb tranquility which did not betray them at the moment of their death, which meant they walked into death as they had walked through life, without fear, not sardonically, not trembling, and not with bravado, but with a kind of strange serenity that was quite clear to the pagan world, quite unknown to the pagan world. And according to some of the historians, it was this strange ability of the Christian to live with joy and die without fear, which was the real reason for the success of the Christian movement in the West and in the East. Now, that's one illustration of what equipping the saints meant at a certain crucial time in history. But take another one. In the 10th and 11th century, the decline of the schools, the general stupefaction of the clergy. Remember, the church was by then 1,000 years old. The corruption of European society, the decline in public and private morality, was such a thing so filled with the stench of rottenness that one wondered if the church could survive, let alone if social order could survive. And just at this moment, there came a saint, Francis of Assisi. Francis, in the words of his biographer, G.K. Chesterton, says, Francis looked out upon a world that was so bad and smelled so bad that he knew that only an absolute purgation would serve to save it. No half measures, it had to be absolutely purged. And therefore the early Franciscan order said, when the world is full of pollution, we must live lives of absolute discipline. And therefore the Franciscan order constituted within the 10th and the 11th centuries a kind of body of people who were equipped with a right diagnosis of what the time needed. And they went into the monastic order. They ate little. They drank not at all. They lived lives of such absolute discipline that they were a startling contrast to the world around them, which gave them a kind of reluctant admiration. In the words of one voice we still have from the 10th century, they said, the world that was without meaning regarded with a strange astonishment these people who seemed to know what the meaning was. Now I suggest these are illustrations of the way God has equipped his church. Let's use a couple more. Think of the time in France when the political situation was as bad as the ecclesiastical situation, and the complete collapse of the whole structure of French society was imminent, and there came this strange girl from the Auvergne, Jeanne d'Arc, and she had, it's a legend, we don't know the truth of Jeanne d'Arc, but the legend has some strange elements in it. This girl who was supposed to have had a dream in which God said to her that she was to lead this people to a reconstitution of both church and state. And ignorant, the peasant girl, supplied only with what she said was an indubitable call from God, by the very madness of her vision, she pulled this generation together and brought off an unbelievable coup, as we would call it, in which the French monarchy again resumed its hold on the French people. Or take one more illustration. In the 20th century, probably take two authentic saints, I think, from the 20th century, not in the Christian meaning of saints, that is, believers who were so gifted by the Spirit and by their own perception. And these two are never in contrast. I mean, sainthood is not just a pure gift from God. It's a giftedness, an endowment from God, which people go out to respond to and grasp. Two authentic saints, Albert Schweitzer and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. These were equipped saints who, with the particularity of their mission, they intersected the need of the time with a strange appropriateness. Just when we believed that in the Second World War, when it was believed that anything was for sale, anything could be bought, that people really were no longer possessed of a tough core of honesty and faithfulness, Dietrich Bonhoeffer stands out as one who made a horrifying choice. He had to disobey God in order to obey him. He had to say no to God's institution of the state in order to say yes to what he believed, the higher law, of his conscience. And he did it, and he lost his life in the doing of it. And I've spent time in Germany since Second World War, and if there's one authentic churchman who survives from all that strange period of compromise and waffling and talking out of both sides of the mouth, the man who has, in a sense, reconstituted the faith of many young German Christians is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And the man older, but in a sense of the same century, was Albert Schweitzer. Here was a man marvelously gifted, competent in three areas of learning and technical skill. He was an extraordinarily learned New Testament scholar. One of the great books in the history of New Testament study, The Quest of the Historical Jesus, published in English in 1900, is Albert Schweitzer's work. He also edited the whole great edition of the organ works of J.S. Bach. He was a competent musicologist and an experienced player, indeed, and a recorded organist. He also had an advanced degree in medicine and a doctorate in the particular field of endocrinology. Here was a man with three honorable careers ahead of him, and he chose to blend them all by following his own vision, that in order to, in some measure, be a symbol for the guilt of the Christian West over what had happened for 150 years in Africa, in which people became chattel and were sold by Christian merchants to other Christian buyers, he simply poured his life into the service of the black people in the Congo, as he openly admitted, as a kind of small return in charity for the terrors that had been imposed upon those people ever since the opening of Africa in the 18th century. Now, when we want to talk about equipping the saints, let's not be abstract about it. What we have to do is first think of ourselves as saints. Well, in the old use of the word, that would be a formidable procedure. Most of us couldn't bring it off. But in the right meaning of the word, that's exactly what we are. We are the folk of the church. And there are people here this week who know much more about how in the fields of music and education and communication and parish organization, they know much more about that than I do, and that's what the workshops and modules are for, to give you help in equipping the saints. But all I want to do is simply get the fundamental notion there that each person's equipment, what kind of equipment he or she needs, and how go about getting it and refining it and honing it to your own needs, this is an individual job, and there is only a modest amount of help that anyone else can give you. When you know that as saints, when we know that as saints we need to gain in knowledge, in skill, then it's pretty much up to us to tailor the requirements of our equipment to the nature of our endowments. Now, as a saint, my endowments are other than yours. And I had to look out upon my life and figure if I want to actualize my Christian faith, there are certain things I have to have as equipment. Linguistic knowledge, historical knowledge, biblical knowledge, theological learning. And then it's my job to get these things. The church can't take me into a kind of ecclesiastical warehouse and give me a set of equipment. It's there for my use and my development, but it's pretty much my job. Now that's really all I want to say, because As I say, there are people here on the staff whose life work is doing a good job of helping you find where the right equipment is, or help you make your own. But I want to talk about something else. I think I'll ask the man who nailed me this morning when I came in the chapel. He asked me a question which really set me off on the course that I want to go for the next half hour. And I'll ask him if he will be so kind as to repeat what he said to me this morning. Where is that man? He's got to be around here someplace. Not here?
Right here.
I'll state it. Yeah?
Right.
Okay, come up here and put it on the mic.
I asked you this morning, and I said, how do we know in our life expression when we have received or understand the true calling, the vocation that we have? At what point do we become really full laity and not just small clergy? Not to compete, but how do we understand this and where do we find it?
And then you asked a little more about confusion and bewilderment.
Try
to recover that. Okay. Let me start on the edge of that issue. It's an event that every teacher in college or seminary or university has seen in the last, I suppose, 10 years. Something strange has happened. I started teaching in the seminary in 1943, but it's only in the last 10 years that the students ever asked for courses in spirituality. We had courses in Bible, church history, theology, administration, all these things. And even the word spirituality is not a kind of Lutheran, a Lutheran word. We don't use it much in education, in congregational thinking, or speaking, or preaching. All of a sudden, about 10 years ago, the word began to emerge, and students began not only subterraneously and haltingly, but quite vehemently, saying, we want courses in spirituality. Now, what they meant by courses in spirituality, I think, and I'm only reflecting on this, I'm not sure, I think they got from their colleagues in Roman Catholic Seminary. In Roman Catholic schools, there are whole courses called spiritual formation, in which by certain disciplines of meditation, prayer, study, the young man preparing for the priesthood develops what is called his formation in priesthood, the deepening of his spirituality. Now let's look at the word. By the Spirit, we mean so many things, it's hard to nail down something specific. Look how strangely we use the word. Spirit can mean a kind of vivacity present in a person. Say, these people have a lot of spirit. Or we talk about school spirit or team spirit. We say of a certain horse, it's a spirited horse. We talk about the spirit of a people. And we know what we mean, but when asked to explain exactly what we mean, we're tongue-tied. When we talk about the British spirit, confound it, we all know what we mean in a kind of a groping way. The British spirit is always an understated, deferential kind of thing that when the cards are down is surprisingly tough. And we know what we mean by the French spirit. It's a kind of debonair sitting light, apparently, to crucial subjects, but also terribly patriotic and loyal to everything French. And it's a certain way of doing things that we know is French the moment we meet it. As de Gaulle once said, how are you going to govern a people that have 324 kinds of cheese? the French spirit is a kind of a flair with which things are done. We know it in their furniture, in their clothing, in their food, in the way they do politics, French movies. There is such a thing, but it's very hard to specify. There's an American spirit too, but you try to specify it, and you can't do it. But you know it when you meet it. When I was a young student, or not so young, but when I was a student for a year at Heidelberg in Germany, I was pretty lonely. There weren't many Americans, there were no American students that year in the theological faculty. And I was living all alone in a kind of a dull place. And one night, in the summer, spring evening, the window were open, and I heard a sound I had not heard for a whole year. I'd heard the heavy footsteps of German boots on cobblestones. And all of a sudden, early in the morning, I heard the click, click, click of what was indubitably an American girl walking on spectator shoes with high heels. American girls don't walk the way German girls do. German girls, when I knew them, walked like they were on the way to work or execution. Just click, click, click. Believe me, I rushed to the window and I was quite right. It was an American student on the way to the library or someplace. Now, that's a kind of silly symbol, but you get the point exactly. You wouldn't have laughed if you hadn't. There's an American spark, vivacity, way of doing things, even this American sense of humor, which is slightly crazy, but only negotiable among fellow Americans. Well, when therefore we use the word spirit, now we're coming to the point. The word spirit, and it's true of Holy Spirit or of the human spirit alike, it points to a kind of inward reality. Spirit is always that mystery at the center of things which constitutes the thing it is, and not another thing. It's that ungraspable, ductile, evanescent quality of a thing whereby it is the thing it is, indubitably. When a mother says of her children, well, John has a different spirit than Michael, she doesn't mean just to call a catalog of characteristics, although those may be included, but it's an ineluctable but definite interior quality. Now, therefore, when my students come to me in the last 10 years, as they come to other people in education, and say, we want courses in spirituality, what are they both acknowledging and requiring in the same request? They're acknowledging that their American life, even their church and religious life, is a terribly outward and banal and conventional thing. And they want a deepening of inwardness. Now, this is, to me, so important that it's worth spending the rest of my time on. What do I mean by a deepening of inwardness? How is our inwardness called forth? Now, we all have depth as a potentiality of being human. We all have an inwardness, a deep, partly secret, non-negotiable, private, immaculate life on the inside, which is not identical with your inside. And often it lies silent, speechless, latent, and often unruffled within us. But at some moment or other in every person's life, there comes an event, or a word, or a intersection which shakes it alive. And we are frightened at those moments because a secret that had been silent and lay quiet is suddenly awakened. And we respond to that either with delight over this new awakening or with fear, because it discloses to us possibilities of our interior life which we can cover by the newest thing, reading about the beautiful people, going to movies, losing ourselves in our job, in the routine of our lives. We can anesthetize inwardness by preoccupation. We can keep it quiet and slumbering, but it has its way of taking its reprisals. You remember in the wonderful play of Arthur Miller, I think, in about the late 40s, The Death of a Salesman, in which Willie Loman, a conventional, hale and hearty good fellow, loud, boisterous, always saying more in his boasting than he ever accomplished. Nevertheless, there was a kind of sweetness about this man, even in his loud-mouthed boasting, because to boast too loudly means there's a secret, there's a kind of secret nostalgia for what you have not done, which is underneath the loud boasting. It's like Shakespeare's word, "The lady doth protest too much." When one talks too much about what he has, you begin to suspect he has less than he's boasting about. So when Willie dies, there's a wonderful passage in the play when his wife, the funeral, says, "Such men, such persons must be attended to." That is, there was more to Willie than met the eye of the other button salesman with whom he got drunk regularly on the road. Now, everything in American life, and let's stick with America now, though what I'm saying is not just true, I think, of America. Everything in our American life and culture, in our current idolatries, tends to coarsen inwardness. Either coarsen it, or stifle it, or give it a very low evaluation. Our whole notion of what it means to be a people is pretty much in terms of power. You have only to listen to the last Republican convention to know that what we want is power. We don't only want to protect ourselves, we want to be number one. As if somehow, God bless America, she is by divine providence intended by God to be number one. Which is, of course, blasphemous. How about all the other people in the world? So the notion, our own self-consciousness has been, identity has been equated with power. Worth has been equated with possessions. Status has been equated often with post. What post are you? Where are you on the totem pole? This kind of rampant materialism, secularism, gauging worth by the clinking coins of material that can be counted and weighed, this has worked a kind of coarsening of our American spirit, of the vision with which our fathers came to this place, and given us a kind of guilt which every modern novelist has seen, a kind of sense that we've gone wrong someplace. When did we begin to unravel? I know I'm talking about what's true here. Because in college and university audiences in the year 1976, at our bicentennial year, I was asked to make certain lectures in American universities about the American experience, and I cranked out a lecture which I did at about 8 universities on the American experience, and I watched the faces of the audience as I repeated that wonderful statement from William Davenport in 1684, when he addressed a great conference of New England people at Hartford, Connecticut, which they then called Out West from Boston. At Hartford, Connecticut, he said, and I remember the almost exactly, "We have been dispatched by God and by history on an errand into the wilderness to light in this place a candle on a hill to be a light to the nation." Now that's the kind of thought about America and what we were for that, at least in that one community in New England and in others down the seacoast, that animated the establishment of this country. And 1976, 2 years after Watergate, I could see the faces of those students, hundreds of them, when I used these quotations from early American history. John Adams, John Quincy Adams, Samuel Adams, Madison, Jefferson, back of that Davenport, Eliot, Cotton Mather. These statements of the American reality as an errand for God and for history into the wilderness of the old world. And when I added, "We have blown it," you could see a sense of affirmation in the faces of these students, and I think we all share it. Now this, this says something about the moment in which we are trying to learn how to equip our saints, ourselves to be God's saints in this moment. And I'd like to suggest that we put this notion of equipping the saints over against this moment in the history of our people, we might get some idea of what the church ought to move more fully to become, and we as people more fully to witness to. Let me attempt that finally. The great church, the great age of the church is over. That is, talking about great, in the world's terms, the great age of the Christian church is over. In the sense that the church will ever again, for the foreseeable centuries, be a triumphal, powerful element in men's lives, a powerful voice in culture, that the church's message about God and Christ and sin and grace, that will ever again be a presupposition of culture. That is gone, maybe gone forever. Now what I mean by presupposition, I can dramatize by asking you to think of the time of Luther and the Reformed. When the Augsburg Confession was written, our fathers did not undertake to defend the doctrine of God. Who doubted it? Luther didn't have any different understanding of the doctrine of God theologically than the Roman Catholic theology had. The first article is an almost exact transcript of Roman Catholic theology. No, God was simply there. Everybody knows there's a God. Now, 9/10 of the population, I don't think I'm overstating it, the very doctrine of God cannot be taken for granted. Now, Shakespeare came very within the next century after Luther, and I just pick up a little from Hamlet. You recall when the three guards are standing on that grim and chilly wall outside of the castle. It's Christmas Eve, and Shakespeare, who was a kind of run-of-the-mill Christian, he said, "It is a nipping and an eager air, Bernardo. Some say that ever since that season comes wherein the Savior's birth is celebrate, the bird of dawning singeth all night long." See, Shakespeare can just throw in a little legend about Christmas, that when Christmas Eve comes, there was a legend the cock, the chicken, crowed all night long. Ever against that season comes wherein the Savior's birth is celebrated, the bird of dawning singeth all night long. Shakespeare could assume that everybody knew that, and everybody believed it. Even when his villains swear, they swear by Christ's blood. So that the doctrine of God, the doctrine of Christ, the doctrine of human sin, of divine judgment. Just 2 nights ago, I saw the second part of the lives of Henry VIII, the wives of Henry VIII, and the execution of Anne Boleyn. Well, she was not exactly a saint, and Henry certainly was not, in an ordinary term. But both of them, both of these rascals, believed that there is a God, that God will judge them. And Anne could talk to the people who were about to chop her head off and say, there will be another grand court, and you, sir, pointing to Cromwell, you will come before another court. You see, God, Christ, the truth of the Christian story, these were presuppositions. They are not that any longer. And therefore, what we now call the life of the church is in part the continuing momentum on the last gas tank of that tradition. But that tank has got to run on not a new kind of gas, it's going to be the Word of God and the sacraments. But we've got to be Christians, believe, preach the gospel in a world from which all of those unquestioned presuppositions are, if not denied, quietly gone out of mind. My own children are not active members of the church. They have not denied the Christian faith. They do not find it particularly interesting. What I'm saying is that the Christian faith is not for little children. Now we must introduce children into the tradition of worship and devotion and the church and hymnody and liturgy. But the notion that the Christian faith is somehow discloses its awesome meaning to innocence, to immaturity, to a life that has not known ambiguity, tragedy, that is simply not true. Things have to disclose themselves in their reality before the relevance of the Christian faith has force. And we in America, I think, have not yet gone through enough of a historical or personal ringer to reconstitute the truth of the Christian claim for our time. So that, what does this mean? For us, you and I, for us to be equipped to be God's saints, that is, transparencies in our personhood through which God can be seen and Christ can be present. In order to be that, our first duty is to cultivate inwardness in a time which yearns for it. The rise of the cults, the Jesus people, the Robert Schulers of this world, mean that there is a profound desire for an inward pattern of meaning, something to hang on to that $64 question. The cults of this world are on the whole giving a 25-cent answer, and they will ultimately self-destruct by their own inadequacy. But it's the task of our community, with a Catholic depth to it, to preserve the great story in all of its tragic dimensions for the tragic times ahead. Let me go at it another way. What do I mean by the tragic sense of life? You know, we've been so busy with our guitar playing and celebrating and dancing and jumping around in many congregations that we've forgotten that Jesus was executed on a cross. He was not a success. He was done in. By a tragic sense of life, I mean something like this. Life, our own life, each of the life, your life and mine, it has come into existence without our will. We were given our life. Our life, biologically, is the work of our parents. Spiritually, our life is a mystery from God. This life undergoes a period of wonder, opening, every power maturing, every sense getting more and more bewildered and sensitive and richly fed, sound and sight and smell and world experience, personal, societal, world historical. We pass from the simplest language to the marvels of poetry, from the simplest little tune to the magnificence of the music of the world. We pass from building little blocks to a life of admiration, from the great constructions of mankind, from building blocks in a play table to Chartres Cathedral, then to the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Life is an unfolding, but all unfolding carries within it a gigantic promise. But there comes a time when the unfolding turns toward its inevitable end. This is what I mean by the tragic sense of life. There's a British teacher at Cambridge many years ago who, in an opening address of when he was appointed to the chair of English history or English literature at Cambridge, I have a copy of his inaugural address, which I've read many times. Cambridge at that time was all men. So you can understand his first sentence. He was addressing the university to say why English literature belongs to the equipment of an educated person. Is it possible, gentlemen, that you can have read one or two or three of the acknowledged masterpieces of our English literature and not have had it borne in upon you that they are great because they are alive, that they traffic not with cold celestial certainties, but with men's hopes and fears and aspirations, with men's breakings of the heart, with all that gladdens, saddens, maddens us men and women on this brief and mutable tragic which we call life, which yet must be home for a while, the anchorage of our hearts. That's a great statement. All the breakings of the heart that constitute human life. What I'm saying is that the depth of the Christian story of God disclosed in Christ, Christ crucified, the depth of that story is not meant for the Mary Poppins mentality of this world. It is not meant for the local Rotary Club vision of American history. It is meant for our understanding of the tragic event that all life comes into, unfolds, falls back upon itself, and dies. When we become aware of the passage, the pathos of our passage from birth through maturation and joy and delight to the pathos of death, then we're ready for a story big enough. And I would suggest until national history and a national experience makes us aware of that, that we too are only in historical reality. And all historical peoples come into history, unfold, and pass away. And America the Beautiful is no different. We have our time and our obligation under God, but we too are not eternal. And a nation is no more eternal than a person, though the space of its temporality may be centuries and not decades. Now, when that knowledge comes to people, that is what I mean by spirituality. And that's what we've been lacking. Often our churches have been kind of cheerleading cadres for Jesus. But we forget that Jesus did not die in bed. He died crying, "My God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Which means that this image of the man, our man, standing within the infinite horror of life and dying in faith, that's the great story. And it's the only story that's big enough when the tragic sense of life is fully grasped. Now let me conclude with a couple illustrations of what I mean by a tragic sense of life. There's some of you know the poetry of Dylan Thomas, died by his own excesses, but a great, great Welsh poet. He has a poem, Fern Hill. It's a little recollection of his childhood days. In a sense, the way Dylan Thomas in his poetry remembers his childhood is a kind of a symbol of the way all of us look back to the days of our own innocence, to the days when the burden and the mystery and all the heavy weight of experience, contradiction, ambiguity, before all these things invaded our happy life. Well, Dylan Thomas looks back at his days when he was a child on his grandfather's farm, with the apple trees and the fields, and a small boy walking through the grain fields, and the house in the distance looked as high as the hay, or the hay as high as the house. And he wrote a wonderful poem called Fern Hill, and one stanza I think I can recall for you. Now, I didn't intend to make this speech this morning, so if I can't get it all right, the best I can do. The stanza begins like this. And honored by foxes and pheasants by the gay house, and happy as the heart was long under the new-made clouds in the sun born over and over, I ran my heedless ways. My wishes raced through the house high hay, and little I cared in my heedless dreams that time in all his tuneful turning allows so few and such morning songs, until the children, green and golden, follow him out of grace. Now this notion that time allows us so few songs in the morning of our life, until the gravity of conscience, of contradiction, of ambiguity, of mixture of the good and the evil in everything. This is what experience means. This is what it means to grow up, is to know that. And never to grow up means to anesthetize himself from that by booze or by drugs or by the false gods of success, but to be a person is to experience contradiction, ambiguity, sin, even one's own. Then, to know if there is to be something, if there's to be some deed from God that has the size of that tragedy, that deed has got to become us in order to authenticate itself. And that's exactly what Jesus Christ did. He became us. How can he solve our problem except by becoming our problem? When children in Sunday school say, "Why did Jesus Christ have to die?" the child has got intimation of the ultimate tragic situation. He had to die because we do. And if he does not join us in our dying, what authority has us to say, "As I live, you too shall live"? Because as we die, he too, and died worse than we do, in order that no man shall ever say of God, God, you don't know what it's like to be a man or a woman. Well, he does. She does. But I think, and I don't think this has much helped you in terms of practicality, but the practicalities come if we get the central vision right. What the Lutheran and other Catholic churches have got to be in the generation that lie ahead is, I think, as follows. We're going to be a smaller church than we've ever been before. We're going to be a leaner, tougher church. Not many people anymore will be automatic Christians. Well, my family were Lutheran, I was baptized Lutheran, I was confirmed at dear old St. John's, and I'm a sort of a lubricated Lutheran. I just slide into it. No, that's that done. People have to decide to be in the church now. You don't just slide into it by family inheritance, the way you slide into grandfather's membership in the golf club or the Union League Club or something. You don't inherit your grandfather's seats at the opera or his pew at the church. To be a Christian is going to be a choice from now on. Our children are going to have to decide. I think my kids are going, I don't think they're so stupid as not to be pushed into asking for an answer adequate to the tragedy and the ambiguity that their unfolding life will bring to them. And then they may be ready. What this means for confirmation, catechization, are deep questions for educators right now, and I won't wander off into that field. But to end with a final figure, I'd steal it again from one of my favorite, most inspiring authors, Gilbert Chesterton. Interestingly, after 40 years eclipse, all of his books are now being republished. In the third decade of this century, Chesterton, a great British journalist, wrote some books called Orthodoxy, Heretics, The Life of St. Francis, and some remarkable detective stories with a Christian theme called the Father Brown story. These are all being republished. That means something, because Chesterton is marked by a sense for life's tragic ambiguity, from which only a heavenly tragedy of equal size will be redemptive. And the figure I want to end with is one from Chesterton. He said, when God wanted to attack redemptively the lost human situation, he drove into that situation like a bright sword. And he went into it up to the hilt himself. And the hilt that protrudes, like the hilt of any good sword, has the form of the cross. Thank you very much. Says we have time for a few questions before the coffee clutch.
We will take a few minutes for questions, and then we will skip the discussion, and after the coffee we'll move directly into the workshop. So since Dr. Sittler is leaving us at noon today, it might be good to have a few questions right now, and then we'll break for coffee and move into the workshops.
That makes sense. What time is it?
It's about 9:50. So we got a few minutes here until 10 or so. Okay.
Concerning the church, America, and the future of the church, and your comments that anybody's treasure.
I'll try to summarize for Dr. Sidler. If I didn't, Ken, the question had to do with the your comments about the church today in American society, which has emphasized success, etc. What, in light of the past history where the emphasis has been on make all you can and give all you can, to the Lutheran kind of understanding where it tends to say we don't like success, we don't want it, where should the church be in that tension between kind of becoming a part of culture and then kind of responding to that, or in a sense kind of denying the American dream and trying to find a new lean, tough stance toward it? Is that somewhat true?
Can you come up here and ask it? I can't hear you back there.
It really concerns me because where there was a Henry Ford that made the automobile, couldn't there be a Christian who would make an automobile that would work in our society, and he's going to make a lot of money doing that. And now, how is he to use his money? And I keep coming back to what John Wesley said, make all you can, save all you can, and give all you can.
Well, when John Wesley said that, it was not in the full flesh of a managerial financial society either. I won't comment about that. I'd have to have the whole context, but that's a big question. Let me refer you to something and help you work it out for yourself. Get the now in paperback book by Richard Niebuhr called Christ in Culture. All of you, it's a book written by a marvelous theologian, a splendid writer, that not a lay person here can't stand it. If you think that these theologians write books you don't understand, try Niebuhr. Richard Niebuhr's Christ in Culture. He said, in the history of the church, the community has related itself to culture in roughly five ways. Christ against culture. And these still exist. Groups that separate themselves completely as possible, from the aspects of culture, music and dance and theater and literature and often public education. They dress very simply, like the Amish and the Mennonite communities, they remove themselves from the polluting and corrupting and weakening forces of the culture. Leo Tolstoy tried that in his own life and wrote his book on Confessions out of that experience. Christ against culture. There's a second group that's exact opposite, a way of being a Christian. Christ and culture. You simply say that, or believe that, the highest achievements of culture are already a work of Christ. A work of the ideal life, the good life, manifesting themselves in beautiful music, in architecture, political forms, forms of social life, so that Christ and culture are not only not separated, they are fused together. That the cultural life is the Christian life. The third one is Christ above culture. And this is the life of a lot of Lutherans, that our Christian life floats with a kind of elevated liturgical irrelevance up here. It begins at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning and generally closes at about 12:30. The rest of the week is the life of culture, the insurance business, the club, whatever we do in business or in teaching or whatnot. But up here we float up on Sunday morning and we sing about God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit and all these lovely things. It's a floating, elevated faith which has no communication up or down with anything else. Christ above culture. He is too great, too good, too pure to be ducked into or infused into this filthy world. This filthy world in which we're doing very well, usually. Christ above culture. Fourth, Christ the transformer of culture. That Christ and culture are to be so related that the powers, the images, the presence, the judgment of Christ, God present in Christ, shall always be the burr under the saddle of culture, the conscience of the state and of the individual, the always better that animates culture toward always higher and more just and good achievement. Now the Christian community has often played that role. I think it still does in many cases. Christ is a transforming power in culture. And the last one, which is most like the classic Lutheran position, is Christ and culture in paradox. When the culture says yes and affirms its own goodness, its own success, its own adequacy, the people of Christ say no. And when the culture in despair and in a sense that nothing has any meaning, the little cadre of the church says, but yes. I think that's where we belong, really. And interestingly, the church that sets out less self-consciously than any other not to make culture an idol does more for culture. J.S. Bach and Buxtehude and Pachelbel and Schwelink and Luther, these are not of men who aim to shine in the world of culture. And yet the cultural creations of those who sought to glorify God through beauty and work and construction, they have been among the greatest contributors to culture. So that you do not create culturally powerful things by setting out to do it. You set out to do a good job, to make the most of the endowment you've had, to get a vision, and then achieve the skill to realize it in music, in dance, in theater, in writing, in sculpture, in whatnot. And you end up contributing what you never intended as a particular contribution. Old Bach didn't write his cantatas, you know, to have them published 200 years later. He wrote because next Sunday the Herr Pastor said, get along with it, I gotta have it for Friday night. And that man churned out a new one every week, simply because it's gotta be done. There's gotta be a cantata, and the opening chorale for the Sunday was already given. That was the theme. And he had a librettist who wrote some awful stuff, which is only redeemed by the magnificence of Bach's music. You read some of those, the words that go with those cantatas, they're enough to make you weep. They're full of real pieces, I'll tell you. But Bach, he did a job with what he had. And then he wrote at the bottom, Soli Deo Gloria, to the sole glory of God. Turned it over to the choir and forgot about it. It's a strange paradox that when Christ and culture are in paradox, then I think each does its own thing. And when we try to confuse them and try to create a Christian culture, we don't have either plain Christianity or culture. Well, I can't answer your question. I've given you a long-winded evasion of your question. But I suggest that Niebuhr's book would help you kind of place where your own Christian faith is and help you see clearly maybe how your endowments ought best self-equip themselves for service.
Another question? Yes.
Yes. You kind of made a light shine in my life this morning when you were talking about the comment that true Christianity comes with maturity, not till we know the true difficulties in life, that we realize we are recognized the gift of grace that we live by, can we fully understand our Christianity. Which leads me to question, what are we doing you made the mention that the young people in our congregations are being taught the traditions, the life of Christ, which is all well and good, until they too come of an age where they begin to think possibly of puberty or whatnot. And in my own life, there was a stage between puberty and just in the last year or so that it was a limbo, a life of, yes, I am a Christian, I'm not sure what it means, I believe in it to an extent, but it was a tremendous span of my life that was limbo. And I'm questioning you as to what we can do to make this transition to the very young, to where I found that I couldn't question, I didn't know my Christianity until I really had difficulty in my life. And I would like for us to be able to make that transition for others smoother or a better understanding of what Christianity really is.
That's an inevitable question and a very good one, and I'm not sure. I cannot really answer it, but I can tell you how I deal with what I cannot adequately answer. I remember my wife, when we were rearing a family, she said a number of wise things, but one of them was, don't over-answer a child's questions. Answer the question at the level of the question. Give the answer adequate to the question, but don't say, and now this gives me a chance to tell him about the birds and the bees, you know. Answer the child's question at the level, then when he asks a question at another level, speak to that. I think she was quite right. I don't think we can give answers that have been squeezed out of experience to people who have not the appropriate experience. You see, it's like, I've often used, it's like trying to teach the great novel Moby Dick to children or to high school kids. It's an awful shame. I read Moby Dick in high school and knew it was a whale of a good yarn. But Moby Dick is a great deal more than a story about a man chasing whales. It's probably the greatest novel ever written in America. I had enough sense when I was in college to reread it. Then I began to see what this Moby Dick is a symbol for, the malignant evil of the world. And Ahab is a great symbol for man's pride in the world. And the great deep is a symbol for the ultimate mystery of God himself. So that we ruin great things by assuming too early that they can be transmitted to children. I think the Catholics were quite right for many centuries when they said, get the kids into the habit and then let their questions grow up to the size of the great answers. You see, so get them into Sunday school or church school, get them into choir, glue them in by anything that'll stick. I'm dead serious about that. And in my own parish, we found out that in Slap Happy Chicago, a quite sober liturgical church has a strange appeal. Where anything goes out there, in here we have to do it a certain way. And these kids sort of like that, it's different. So we dress them to the hilt and march them and carry candles all over the place. Okay, if we got to stick them in with candle wax, okay. Keep them there until the unfolding life asks the kind of question that the Christian answer intersects. You see, I cannot understand how a cross could be redemptive until I've carried a few and have been pastor to people as I was in my parish. Who carried bigger crosses than I ever had to carry. They got to understand what a cross is made out of and how heavy it can be. Well, I think that's the answer. Now, how are we going to make the glue? I don't know. But I'm pretty tolerant about all kinds of things that we do with young people that keep them attracted to the community, awaiting the time when the meanings become clear. I know in my own life, I was helped my father in the parish at the communion and lit the candles and got the offering plates and all that kind of thing, and I didn't know what it was all about, the language particularly. But I listened to it. And I became aware only when I was fully mature of how haunting and memorable that ancient language was. It was in my head without my knowing that it got stuck there. And that's why I lament the banality of the modern liturgical language. There's nothing memorable about it. I remember as a child hearing, "And with thy spirit," I don't know if, "and also with you," has the same sticking power. I doubt it.
Okay, I think we're going to have to, I know there are lots of questions, but I think we're going to have to take a break, so we have a half an hour for coffee, and we'll meet in our workshops at 11:45. Remember, they're posted outside the door. 10:45. Thank you, Dr. Simmons.